Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. In the shadow of the death of Pope Benedict, the airwaves have been full of celebrations of his life. We have it from our Lord that by their fruits you shall know them. The record that Pope Benedict left behind in his encyclicals, the courageous and intelligent restatement of Orthodox faith in the face of a cultural progressive onslaught, are being given their due in public tribute across the airwaves and in print. But one more of the fruits, one of the most creative and generous acts of the late Pope, was the formation of the Ordinariate of Our Lady of Walsingham. Through the Ordinariate, Anglicans who longed to be reconciled with the Mother Church were not only given a route to return, but the means of bringing with them their most beautiful prayers and liturgy, which, once purified of its Protestantism, found its place at the centre of Catholic spirituality. The means by which this daring and generous act of reconciliation were negotiated was brought about by a few courageous and determined Anglican bishops. At the centre of the Anglican initiative, one of the actors in the drama was the then Bishop of Ebbsfleet, Andrew Burnham. Now Monsignor Burnham, Father Andrew reflects both on how this miracle of creative ecumenism was accomplished and on the legacy of Pope Benedict XVI in the light of this unique reparative act in the history of the Church in the West. Father Andrew joins me now. Monsignor Andrew Burnham, we've known each other for a while, and it's a great pleasure to have this conversation together. I could say that Pope Benedict brought us together, really. But before we talk about his work with the Ordinariate, I'd just like to ask you if you have any fond memories of ever meeting him, because that would be a way to begin something like this. But I know what you're going to say, but I'm looking forward to your saying it.
Okay. Well, the answer is I didn't ever meet Pope Benedict because I was too busy at the time doing something much more important. To explain that, I was at the Casa Santa Maria, Santa Marta in Rome, which is where the present Pope lives, but in those days was just a posh hotel for visiting clergy. And we were having a meeting there about Anglicanorum Caetibus, which was the encyclical which the Pope had produced. And I said to my minders there, can I go to the general audience so I can meet the Pope? And they said, no, we've got far more important things to do than that. We've actually got to get all this worked out. So sit down and let's get on with it. So I didn't ever get to meet him. Although I did go to Coughton Park, where there was the Beatification Mass, which was later on that year in 2010. But I saw the Pope at a distance, but I didn't get to meet him.
Seeing him at a distance is the privilege that many Catholics have. Anyway, you were busy masterminding the rescue of Catholic Anglicanism rather than simply pressing the flesh for a few seconds, which, although it's always very nice, I think what you were doing is probably much more important. And for all those whose lives have been improved by the Ordinariate, I think we should say thank you very much to your minders for persuading you to give up your papal tourism and to keep your nose to the grindstone of rescuing Anglican patrimony.
I was accused, as I was walking around St. Peter's Square, wearing a white jacket and a white hat. It was springtime in Rome, and with my dog collar and everything else. I had a phone call from somebody in Rome saying, why are you walking around St. Peter's Square looking like an English tourist? Make sure when you come to the meeting tomorrow you have a suit.
They'd obviously been watching too many 19th century films, but it is the gift of a certain kind of Anglican clergyman to look very eccentrically and distinctively English walking around Rome. Can we talk about Pope Benedict and your view of him as a pope? As the dust is beginning to settle on some of the obituaries, they fall essentially into a spectrum where on the one side, on the Orthodox, the traditional side, people are retrospectively enormously grateful for the continuity from John Paul II and for all the giftedness that he brought to the papal office from having guarded the church as prefect of the CDF. And on the other side, you hear those who are more devoted to the spirit of Vatican II saying, well, he was all right as far as he went, but he missed all the really important balls in the air because of his traditional obscurantism. So where on the spectrum of Benedict appreciation do you fall?
Oh, I'm a firm fan of Benedict, I think, as you'd expect, really, because of the association with the Ordinariate. I think quite a lot of modern commentary takes history out of context. I mean, I think that's just a general comment. So we keep looking back on previous ages and judging them by the standards of the present. And we then have to topple statues and we have to revise history and apologize for things that we can't possibly be blamed for because it was nothing to do with us personally and all that. And that's the kind of mood in which a long life, and with it an important life, is sometimes viewed, and I think is therefore distorted. So Benedict is accused of being associated with Nazism, for instance, which is ridiculous. He was press ganged into the Hitler Youth as a child. He was had as little to do with Nazism as he possibly could. He abhorred it, and his family did. But that there's guilt there. Is ascribed to him. The child abuse stuff is, he laboured away. It was his Friday penance to deal with the difficulties of priests who were abusing children. And yet he's now being said not to have dealt with the problem properly at all. It's the, as judging things by the standards of another age. And I think our modern awareness of some of these things is has changed so sharply in the last 20 years. That we're in danger of misjudging the previous decades, I think, in that respect. So I think he is very, very definitely a contributor. I think he is a doctor of the church. He will be once he's declared, once people absorb and read his theology. A very great man, a very great mind, a very gentle and kind person, not the Rottweiler of the obituaries. So I think I take a very benign view of him.
Yes, I agree with you completely. I've been reading much more assiduously than I had in the past, as one does when people die. And I'm astonished at the extent to which his father, as a policeman, set about almost a one-man resistance movement against Nazism in terms of tipping people off what the Nazis were doing and using radios illegally in order to make sure they had the right information. The idea that a young German boy in Bavaria should have been in any way tainted by association with a political philosophy that they despised is not only bad history, but it's character assassination of the worst kind, which people are engaging in, partly because of this development of guilt by any kind of association. And then you're right too, I think, about doing everything he could do in terms of sexual abuse of all kinds, which is probably a great deal more prevalent in the church than any of us had ever known. I mean, inevitably, it's under the covers. So was it your view that the scale of the sexual abuse was one of the things that led him to resign? In other words, in choosing to resign, he did it as an ethical decision, precisely because this needed dealing with so profoundly. He felt that it was beyond his own physical and mental capacity to do it.
I mean, I really don't know. I don't think we can see that. I mean, the commentators have come up with various theories. One was that it was the sex abuse that finally did it. The other was that it was the financial state of the Vatican that finally did it. Or another one was that the corruption of the Vatican in other respects, the abuse of power and all that. My own view is that it all became too big for him to manage. And so I think he had to make a choice between being a figurehead under whom all sorts of things could happen, if only people were minded to do it, and resigning and letting somebody else take over and do it. And I think he was haunted by the last years of John Paul II, really. I think that's the key to it, where John Paul II clearly carried on beyond his physical ability to do the job. And I think... Yeah, there was Benedict, he was 85 at the stage, he retired, thinking to himself, I can't do this, it's too big for me to do. And who knows which of those various pressures was the straw.
Well, all three were there, and any single one of them would have taxed somebody of huge energy. I'm sure that's true.
And also, I think the other thing is, he was such a good man that I think the contrast between his own personal holiness and his vision of the church and his understanding of the mystery and wonder of God was so different from what he called the filth around him, whatever that filth was, that I think it became intolerable.
Yes, I mean, to be responsible for it, it's bad enough to be responsible for it if one's a clergy person. one feels the weight of other people's sins institutionally very heavily upon the shoulders. If it's bad enough as a priest, it's worse as a bishop and intolerable, I would think, as the Pope. So as you quite rightly say, it could have been any of those three, and the weight of all of them together was profoundly difficult. One of the things that I found myself most touched by is the scope of his theological writing, because it's a fairly rare thing to have somebody who is intellectually astute and who's spiritually well-honed. I mean, you often get people whose writing in spirituality has an authenticity which is deeply moving, and they don't blow you away with their knowledge, because breadth and depth of knowledge isn't the same thing. But he was one of these very rare people who had a profound theological grasp and at the same time had made progress on the route of holiness that only other people could know about. He can't have known about it himself, because one can't take one's own temperature. But I found what he wrote, particularly in Jesus of Nazareth, inspiring is too weak a word, really. It was embedded in a relationship with Christ that was intellectual and of the heart and of the soul. It seemed to me he had the whole package, which was really very rare in theological authors.
Yeah, I mean, I would put it this way. I mean, say something similar. I would say that he brought together scriptural scholarship, along with systematic theology, along with liturgy, along with spirituality, and integrated them all into a whole. And I think that is shown very clearly in Jesus of Nazareth, really, that there he is confronting. I mean, his last words, "I love you, Jesus," that is a kind of summary of what Jesus of Nazareth is. And Jesus of Nazareth is a summary of his endeavors in systematic theology, what he was writing about in Deus Caritas, and in his love of the liturgy and his love of the adornment of the liturgy. It's all of a piece.
What I like about what you've just done is you've replaced my psychological categories with Catholic categories, and I think that's exactly the right thing to do. So I think that's a very powerful way of understanding the way in which he brought together all the different, not departments of faith exactly, but the constituent elements that go up to become compositors of both personal faith, but also our corporate faith as Catholics. The progressives are really very cross with him for his traditionalism, and are writing quite fiercely about it. Can you expand a bit on why you endorse his traditionalism rather than see it as some form of lacunae on his journey into cultural enlightenment?
Yeah, well, I think if I did it by analogy, if you think of somebody running a greengrocer in the local village, you could see that various people in the village say, well, if only that chap would start selling some hardware as well, it'd be much more useful than just doing greengroceries. So why doesn't he turn the greengrocery store into a general store? And that would be much more to our liking. And, you know, the store changes hands through the generations, and each new proprietor continues to sell green groceries, and the locals continue to say, why don't you sell us some hardware as well? We could do with a general store. And I think the same thing with the papacy is each time you get a new pope, is people queue up to say, now we need you to do the following 10 things to change, because we don't like the church's teaching on this, we don't like the church's teaching on that, we think that's out of date and all the rest of it. Now change it, please. And along comes the Pope, and he says, I'm the Pope, I'm not in a position to change anything, I'm only able to rehearse what the tradition is that I have been given. I mean, that's the deal, isn't it? And I think the liberals, as we call them, are going to rail against that, like the villagers who want the greengrocers to become a general store. And I think the purists will say, well, we're very happy for him to specialise in 24 different sorts of cabbage or whatever else the greengrocer is doing. I think that's my analogy for it, really.
Well, it's a very good one. And he was very clear that hardware, at least in the views of some people, would be seen as the political agenda. And he, as he said so famously at one point, if politics begins to aspire to saving people, then it becomes demonic. It's the church's business to save people. The the ambitions of politics should be less extensive. But when, and so you're right in that sense, hardware and greengrocery need to be kept completely different. But of course, that in my view, and I suspect yours too, is the great weakness of the progressive Christian view, that it fails to keep greengrocery and hardware, it fails to keep spirituality and politics in a proper relationship with each other. His great gift, one that touched both you and I personally, was Anglicanorum Caritatibus and the creation of the Ordinariat. Do you want to talk about, would you mind talking about how you see that now, looking back on it?
Yeah, well, I think I'd like to just tell the story, really, from my vantage point, which is distinctive, and just simply say that when I became Bishop of Ebbsfleet, which I did in 2000, I said to George Carey, who was the Archbishop of Canterbury, who made me Bishop of Ebbsfleet, I said, well, if I do this, my ecumenical quest, which has been a personal one, becomes a corporate one. Because as a bishop, you're responsible for a group of people and their spiritual future. And he said, yeah, that's fine, carry on. So I carried on. And so I went to the meetings of Forward in Faith and all that in London and said to everybody gradually, looking at the situation in the Church of England, I said, my word to you is Rita, Rome is the answer. And I became famous for saying Rome is the answer. But I was in danger of becoming one of those who said it, but without really meaning it. And so in 2008, when I was 60 years old, not being a very good traveller, I decided I must finally go to Rome. So I got in my car and I went to Rome. And I went to Rome with my chaplain and driver. And when I was there, I thought I would call on the Holy Office and I would call on the Congregation for Divine Worship. And I sought out meetings with both of them, managed to get a meeting with both of them. And Keith Newton, who was Bishop of Richborough, when he heard that I managed to fix a meeting, said, do you mind if I come too? And he flew over and joined us. And we went to these meetings, not knowing what to expect, probably expecting to be met by a lowly Monsignor at each stage, telling us how very nice to meet you Anglicans and I hope you live happily ever after. But in fact, we were taken very seriously indeed. We were met by the whole of the congregation, all the officials of the congregation, led by the prefect or president, whoever they are, in each case, then told to go back to England and keep quiet until something happened. So we did. And in 2009, Anglicanorum Caritatibus was published, which was about 18 months after we had been. So that's how it sort of happened. It was our going, my initiative was impatience with all the talk of it, that nothing was ever being done. And there had been a secret meeting of certain diocesan bishops in the Church of England with the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. We heard about that. We didn't hear any details, but we heard rumours of it. And I thought, well, you know, we've got to go in on the coattails of this. And what they said to the Congregation of the Doctrine of Faith is, we've been talking to all sorts of people about interesting ecumenical things, but you seem to mean what you say. So we'll take you seriously. So that's sort of from our vantage point how it happened.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to hear it from the horse's mouth and to hear it as such contemporary history. And I think a lot of people would want to say thank you for several things, for knowing Rita. And for your holy impatience and for being willing to act, whereas as we know, not only ecumenically but in so many ways, people do a great deal of talking and don't act. So it was wonderful to hear how that holy pragmatism produced such a wonderful answer. Did you have any expectation? I mean, presumably, as you say, you were there partly out of impatience and partly out of faithfulness. Partly out of, I guess you'd say, trust. It's up to God to do something. But there must have been a moment when you were surprised at the beauty of the flower that had been planted and was about to break out.
Yes, I was taken completely by surprise. And as I say, we expected to meet a lowly Monsignor at each of the desks who would say something, you know, as is said on those sorts of occasions, has before, after, and during. You know, it's always... you're met with courtesy, but seldom with action. And this was real action.
What do you think it was within Rome itself that had prepared them, at any rate, for being willing to respond so constructively to some kind of initiative like this? Was this something that Michael Ramsay had sown the seeds of initially, or was it a genuine charitableness to a schizophrenic church that part of which wanted to be Catholic and but was utterly unable to be? What do you think led to, well, the great charity that you experienced when you presented yourself?
I think there are a number of things going on. One of them, of course, I mean, preeminently, was the person of Benedict XVI, whose understanding of John Henry Newman, whose reading of Lancelot Andrews and the other Caroline divines had given him a deep interest in Anglicanism. That was one important factor. A second was a sense of the stalling of the ecumenical venture. The archic enterprise had stalled badly with the ordination of women question in the Church of England and the Anglican Communion coming to dominate the agenda. That was another reason. I think another reason was simply that, for reasons which we hadn't appreciated, is that when Keith Newton and I went to Rome, we were more important than we thought we were. That is, we were suffragan bishops of the Archbishop of Canterbury, and therefore were seen as emissaries of a high order. In fact, we'd gone on our own initiative, although we had informed the Archbishop we were doing it. And why we were doing it. And I think the fourth factor was that if you look at the way Roman Catholicism works, is a bishop is in control of his diocese, he's in control of all the churches in the diocese, he's in control of all the clergy in his diocese and all the people in his diocese. And I think there was some naive speculation in Rome, not from the Pope himself, but from others, that if Anglicans came over, bishops came over, they would bring cathedrals, churches, vicarages, large congregations, and all the rest of it. What they didn't realise was that it would lead immediately to fragmentation, which is what happened. Well, we did say to the congregation of Doctrine of Faith, you know, it will probably just be little bands of warriors rather than great armies who will come. And they said, well, never mind, because the point about the Congregation of Doctrine of the Faith is that their interest is in the integrity of the individual and his or her faith. They're not interested in great movements of denominations. The Congregation of the Pontifical Council for Christian Unity, they were interested in denominational movements. CDF was interested in individual movements.
It would have been rather exciting if you could have brought a handful of cathedrals with you, but as we know only too well, that's not...
I mean, what they were all hoping for was, I think they were hoping for, you know, Choral Evensong and Walmsley and Dee and all that.
Absolutely. Well, that and why shouldn't they be so hopeful? That would have been a wonderful thing to bring. However, that's not the way the system works, and didn't work.
No, but it linked up with when Pope Benedict went to Westminster Abbey, it was immediately at home there, and it was all done with great subtlety. We had first of all a verse anthem by a Catholic composer, William Byrd, setting music for the Protestant Reformation. And then we had a Latin motet by Charles Villiers Stanford, which was, he was an Ulsterman who didn't like Roman Catholicism. So we had a kind of integrated beginning to that, which was quite interesting. And I think you can imagine Benedict being immensely fascinated in the detail of it all.
Semiotically very rich, and he'd have been completely on top of it. Yes, I agree. Let's talk about Anglican liturgy. For those who know Anglican liturgy and the great work that, that you in particular have done, but that the whole ordinariate has done in terms of rescuing some of the most beautiful liturgy in the English language and laying it at the service of the Mass and of the Catholic Church. I'm not sure that the rest of the Catholic Church in England quite appreciates it as it ought to, but that's partly because it has so little experience of it. But how do you see the gift of the liturgical richness of Anglicanism once it's been purified of its Protestant errors as playing a role in enriching the wider church?
Well, I think there has to be an acceptance that the work of translation into the vernacular began a long time ago, and that the riches of the vernacular are there and should be there for the whole of the Catholic Church. And I think that it was an accident of the Protestant Reformation that it accelerated the introduction of the vernacular and provoked a counter-reaction from the Council of Trent, retrenching Latin at just the stage when European languages were all changing and becoming more usable. And so it's an accident of history that I think that the Latin Church remained in Latin all that time, and that all the legwork on the vernacular was done initially by Protestants. But I think all that now needs to be healed and integrated into the life of the Catholic Church. And so in the 1960s, when they were embarking upon English translations and other languages too, but when they were embarking on English translations, there was a sort of clean sheet of paper approach. We don't want to be contaminated by this stuff, which is all slightly old-fashioned. Well, let's start again and have something vivid and true. And it was sort of like adopting the Jerusalem Bible for the Bible translation and so on. It was all that kind of movement for contemporary. And it was very exciting. But I think now it all needs to be integrated. And I think the big contribution that we've made by bringing the Anglican Ordinariate liturgy into the Roman fold is to introduce all that language and all that style of language and made it part of the Catholic tradition.
Isn't the right analogy with music that in every century, in the 16th century, the 17th century, the 18th century, you have a style of music and you don't automatically say that the work of Beethoven is better than polyphony. They're different things. The new doesn't expel or rubbish the past. Isn't there scope for something like that liturgically, say that we bring in the most beautiful and the most profound, using words as a vehicle of meaning, in the same way that notes become a vehicle of Sehnsucht and longing and musical vision. Is that a reasonable analogy to have to save us from the tyranny of the most modern and the most superficial?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are powerful lessons to be learned from hymnody, because hymnody had its place in the Catholic Church before Lutheranism broke away. It also has had its place in the Anglican tradition too. And hymnody is a way in which we discover riches from the Catholic tradition from way back, and their translation by modern authors, Victorian authors, but more modern ones as well. And all of that is all part of the rich treasury. My favourite one is Bach, because I think before modern times, Bach wasn't allowed to be heard in Catholic churches because he was a Protestant composer. And you think to yourself, what kind of mentality would exclude, I don't know, a Bach prelude and fugue from the organist's repertoire simply because the organist was supposed to be playing Catholic music rather than Protestant music? It's obviously absurd, and people immediately have accepted instrumental music. But then it goes on to vocal music, and you then say, well, do we have to analyse the Matthew Passion and work out which bits of it are Catholic and which bits aren't and all the rest of it, or can we just accept the whole thing as a glorious expression, a tapestry of faith? And so I think there's a powerful analogy there with the whole of our language and what we do with it.
Do you think that what you've managed to rescue in terms of Anglican liturgy will have some continuing life, rather like an irrigating stream in the life of English Catholic liturgy in the future? Or is it simply something that belongs to the harmonization of ecumenical aspiration of this generation that led to the Ordinariate? The Ordinariate's not going to, however supportive one is of the idea, and one has to be very supportive and grateful for it, it's not going to be an ongoing beacon of renewal in English Catholicism. It was a thing of its time to some extent, but what it brings with it might very well be an ongoing beacon of renewal in terms of the beauty of liturgy.
Well, I think there are various things here. I mean, one of them is that alongside the ordinary, we have to acknowledge the steady stream of Anglicans becoming Catholics in the last 150 years, and particularly in the last 30 years. Many of these, most of these, have not joined the Ordinariate, but have simply joined the Catholic Church. But when they arrive in the clothes they're wearing. They arrive with the mentality they have, and they bring to it some of the tastes and experiences of their past. And I think all of that is part of the rich mix. And the Ordinariate is just simply a crystallized version of that. What we brought is a purified version of 16th and 17th century liturgy, the words of Cranmer as developed in the 17th century, the 1662 Book of Common Prayer. We brought all that, and it's, as it were, been sanitized, but it's been exposed to doctrinal examination. It's been reformulated, repackaged, trimmed around the edges and all the rest of it, and it's there all in place now. Now, if that could happen to 16th, 17th century liturgy, why can't it happen to 20th century liturgy? In 20th century liturgy, there was an enormous flowering in Protestant churches as well as in the Catholic Church, enormous amount of liturgical work done, some of it of extremely high quality. Are we going to avoid all of that because it's modern? Are we going to accuse it of being tainted by liberalism or Protestantism? If so, doesn't that apply to the earlier stuff too? You know, and if we can do the one job on the 16th, 17th century, why can't we do the same thing on the 19th, 20th century? Why can't we have Robert Bridges office hymns, and why can't we have the work of the Church of England Liturgical Commission in the last 30, 40 years? You know, all that, why can it not all go into the same kind of tumble dryer, a laundromat, really, experience, and be sorted, washed clean and sorted and packaged and brought into new life in the whole of the Catholic community?
It does seem to me that the Catholic Church in England, which has a very distinctive history, both culturally and as well as theologically and spiritually, in the last 150 years, must be changed, that the balance of things must be changed to some extent by an infusion of 10% of the clergy. And I don't know how many laity have come across, but bringing with them a number of things like a higher, greater expectations of pastoral care and the dynamics of a parish and appreciation of hymnody and lay participation, of wide variety of things they would have simply part of their own DNA that then get baptized into the fullness of Catholic faith. What do you see under the umbrella of what Benedict has achieved, not just through the Ordinariate, but during this period of history? What differences will it make to the Catholic Church in England and Wales to have so many Anglicans find a refuge in it, to be welcomed home, to have discovered, as you did, that to the so many different questions they had, Rome really is the answer?
Yeah, I think we must avoid triumphalism, because the Catholic Church that I grew up alongside and glimpsed, you know, over the hedge, as it were, I think was a lovely thing and had some very, very important things that the Anglican community lacked. And so I don't think we're in a position of superiority, but I think what we are in a position to do is to bring in a massive cultural infusion, by which I mean, if I look at my village congregation here in East Hendred, most of them are English in their background, though there are lots and lots of others who aren't. But the ones who are English in their background, if you ask them about their Catholic history, you find out it's almost always down to having an Irish grandmother or a French aunt or something else. In other words, their Catholicism, although they are English, actually comes from continental and Irish influences. And very little of it comes through recusancy and through conversion of English people to Catholicism. And that was the thing that shocked me when I joined, really. I expected people to tell me stories of conversion, people to talk about their faith journeys from nothing at all to everything. In fact, they talked about the faithfulness of a grandparent or a parent. My mother was Polish or something like that, you know, that explained their journey. And I think the cultural infusion means that we have brought more Englishness, if Englishness is okay, we brought more Englishness into English Catholicism. And I think that's a massive contribution. And therefore, we have gradually increased our awareness of English spiritual history, English spirituality, English hymnody, English music, and the English way of doing things. And I think that's all good. And I think that is part of the vision that Benedict had.
That's a very concise and powerful way of putting it. The recreation of an indigenous English Catholicism, which is essentially what the goal really should have been once it ceased to be the indigenous Catholic Church of this country in the 16th century. So
it's important to say, Gavin, though, that that's not about making everything more English. It's actually making the Catholicism more authentically multinational, because it's taking hold of the English bit as well.
Yes. No. Well, I was going to say exactly something less elegant than that, but very much so. I mean, allowing it's not a celebration of Englishness, but of indigenousness. I think I've been a bit luckier. In the circles I move in, it's purely a matter of statistical happen chance. I keep on coming across people who are converted Anglicans. I mean. I'm surprised at the extent to which so many of the people who've come in to become practicing Catholics are people who began as Anglicans with a hunger for Catholicism. And I endorse entirely what you said about the beauty of the Catholic Church, which was it didn't need improvement as a church, but what it needed is the only improvement was that it lacked the capacity to draw in the local English to become Catholics as they had been for 1,000 years.
And we still haven't learned how to do that, but we have just got some more tools and more resources.
We're learning how to do it, but I'm hoping that there's going to be an incremental growth of expectation and competence, that as more English people become Catholic, they're willing to say to their English neighbours, you should be Catholic too, without being, not that you would be catty, I might be, but you wouldn't be, but without being uncharitable, looking over our shoulders at what's happened to the Church of England since we both left, which has been a process of very rapid ethical undevelopment. do you see the Catholic Church as continuing to offer a lifeboat to people who can no longer cope with the way in which Anglicanism has unraveled in the face of secular assault?
I mean, the lifeboat is always there, and the lifeboat's always been there. It's been a bit harder to reach the lifeboat in the past than it is now. And I think that the lifeboat remains, and we have to continue to man it and provide it. Whether more people will make use of it, I don't know. I mean, I certainly pray they will. I think that the high church Anglican bit that you and I both belong to has become more and more isolated from the rest of Anglicanism as time has gone on, because the liberal middle of Anglicanism has become much less tangible, really, and the evangelical side has grown exponentially. So I think the high church bit has got to make its mind up, really, what it wants to do. Is it simply prepared to dress up, really, and celebrate nostalgically things that lots of other people also used to believe in? Or is it actually going to examine its roots? And if it does, I think it can only come to one conclusion, which is Rome is the answer, which is what I was saying in the 1990s, and it's still true. I feel very compassionate towards large numbers of people who know that's the answer.
It was the Anglo-Catholics who understood episcopacy. I mean, they took the borrowed concept and intended to invest the borrowed concept of episcopacy with all that was true, that the church invested in it. But how you can then say our bishops, our episcopal line, if it ever existed, is broken, and that we now have women managers who don't have any sense of what episcopacy is at all. I mean, the Anglican Church has given up any sense of imitating Catholic episcopacy, particularly as it's moved to a management culture. And I don't understand how, if you're a would-be aspiring Catholic and believing in episcopacy, when it disappears, you can claim that you somehow remain in a church that's remotely sacramentally authentic. But presumably one has to have other reasons for staying where you are in a particular boat, not realizing that it's leaking terminally and may not float for much longer.
I'm not sure. I see. I think you're a more recent escapee than You're a more recent escaper than I am. I've now, it's 12 years since I escaped from old Mother Damnable, and I make a point, really. I hope nothing I've said in charity offends against this, but I make a point of really not criticizing or commenting on the Church of England beyond stating that which is self-evidently true. And what is self-evidently true is that there is a bigger gap between the high church wing and the others, and that quite a lot of this is manifesting in the debate around same-sex marriage and all that, which I wouldn't even begin to comment on. I just think it has become harder for them, but I'm not saying that there aren't lots of brave souls who are trying to make sense of it in the Church of England as things stand, and I don't want to undermine them. And what I'm very conscious of, and you'll be aware of this, I mean, having been a bishop in the Church of England, is a lot of those little communities which I went round to serve. A bishop in the West Midlands is like minor royalty. You know, it's you go round and you bring a touch of glamour to parish proceedings and so on. And what I've noticed is how many of those communities are still going, and some of them are being looked after by retired priests who are sort of working harder than active priests just to keep all that going. And I'd want to be very gentle about all that, because ordinary folk in the West Midlands or the West of England don't sit there studying ecclesiology and theology. They just carry on going to the church they love and have been to all their lives. And I think some of that is going on and needs to be recognised.
I'm quite glad we're having this conversation, because I think it's important to articulate what we're doing and why we're doing it. So thank you for saying that. I mean, you suggest it might be down to the difference in length of time of escapeeism. It might be, but I don't.
Well, that's rude of me. That was rude. Yes.
No, it wasn't rude of you. You've been assiduously polite and kind, and thank you for doing so. When I came across, I remember one of the videos I saw was of a very gentle and saintly ex-Anglican priest who said, "I'm so grateful for everything the Church of England has given me. I refuse to say anything critical of it." And I thought, gosh, what a beautiful attitude. I will emulate that. I will commit myself to exactly doing those things. But I found myself unable to, not because I'm not as grateful as he was, because I'm immensely grateful. I think I have within me a sense of, well, I would think I'd even call it anger. And it's anger that a fraud is being imposed on the very people that you want to defend, quite rightly, with all your pastoral instincts. I want to release from what I consider is something that is fraudulent and so fraudulent that actually it needs speaking out about. Now, the problem with doing that is it sounds inhospitable, unkind, perhaps pharisaical, certainly holier than thou. My system is better than yours. But I think it partly comes out of a belief that the Anglicanism that we knew and that had so much in it that was capable of sustaining us, albeit with some degree of ambiguity, has actually been so badly broken that the promise of the church to act as a church for them, it's almost as if the river splits in two different directions, and down one part of the river will direct you to the harbour where you can be welcomed and be safe, but the other part of the river will take you over some very dangerous falls which will destroy you. And I think my sense of the reason why I'm more willing to speak out, though it sounds much less kind, is because I think that the Anglican Church has now become not a tributary but part of a river, the end of which is disaster and danger for those who want to be faithful to Jesus and faithful to his church, because of the way in which the root, that the navigation has taken. So I don't think it's to do with length or brevity of conversion, and I hope it's not to do with kindness. So I wouldn't be surprised if you're much kinder than I am. But in my case, one of the reasons why I find myself driven to be articulate, it also is to do with what you were quite rightly saying, is the need to reach out to one's fellow travelers and say, look, there are very important differences between these two ways of being a Christian. And one is so compelling and so healing and so sacramentally powerful that by allowing yourself to remain in the other one, you do damage to your soul. So I hope it's as much kindness. I hope it's two different kinds of kindness that lead to us both taking these different attitudes.
Yes. I mean, I'm certainly not claiming to be anything like that saintly priest you were describing who manages to leave with gratitude on his lips and never has a critical thought. I don't think I could quite aspire to that. But I think the problem with Anglicanism, and it's not the fault of any Anglicans, is that the whole enterprise, as set out by Aidan Nichols in The Panther and the Hind all those years ago, is that it's actually built on a view of society we no longer have, cuius regio, eius religio, kind of society, where the important thing is to discover what the religion of the state is and then to fall into line with it. And I think that doesn't work anymore for all sorts of reasons which we're only too aware of. Occasionally we glimpse what it must have been like. We glimpse that with the funeral of Queen Elizabeth, and we will glimpse it again with the coronation of King Charles. But already people are doing kind of textual analysis of the King's Christmas message as compared with the Queen's Christmas messages over the years, and are saying things are subtly shifting. And I think there is a sense in which Anglicans will eventually have to conclude that they are a church of the Protestant Reformation, and that the authentic expression of that is evangelical, and that the rest of it is wishful thinking, really.
I think that's true, and I'm one of those who has detected a subtle shift and looks at the trajectory and draws conclusions from it. Let's come back to Pope Benedict, history will judge it inevitably in its own way. What would your favourite, your most treasured, the aspect of Benedict you're most grateful for personally be as we head towards his funeral and say our prayers and commend his soul to God?
I think it's all there in Deus est Caritas, God is love, his setting out of the nature of God, reminding us, which was published on Christmas Day 2005, his first year, where he sets out and he has this idea of our love being eros towards God and his love towards us being agape and us being enfolded in that purified love. And I think that's the thing that I'm most grateful for, because I think that's what he acted out in the life of the church. And I think Anglicanorum Chaetibus is an acting out of that. So I feel that although I never met him, which is where we started, although I met him, I felt that he knew me, and I felt that he personally welcomed me, even though it was all done, one step remove. And I think that he was the father of the church, and it's very sad to lose your father.
Monsignor Andrew Burnham, thank you so much for sharing in this conversation and enriching it. We're very grateful, and we continue to mourn the loss of our father and to pray for his soul. Bless you and thank you.
Thank you very much.